Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's Thursday talk. I'm quite excited tonight. I've got two good friends with me today, with a wealth of knowledge, so it's going to be very exciting. I'm very excited. I'm sure you've all seen the flyer, and that's why you're here, Rewiring the Anxious Brain. And we're having a little chat before tonight's program, and it was kind of a feeling amongst us how in today's society and world how we all feel some form of anxiety in our lives, whether it's at work, whether it's at home, pressures with family, pressure with finances, just pretty much everything we do. Sometimes we look out the window and the clouds are grey and we get anxious. So, you know, this anxiety exists with us in every little form, in every little way, and sometimes we don't even pick up on it because it's so subtle. So I think it's a great topic to explore, and we've got two great people, Heather Mason and Neville Hodgkinson, with us today as well. So, just a little bit of brief to tonight's talk. If you've got your mobile phones, if you can put them onto silent or vibrate if you're expecting an important call, but if you could turn the sounder off, that'd be very helpful. It may wake me up when I'm snoozing halfway through, but no, if you put it on silent so the conversation can flow, it'd be quite nice. We're not expecting any fire alarms tonight, so if there is one, just follow me. I'll be running as fast as I can through one of the doors. But there's ushers about, and the fire exits are signposted down there, and the exits at the front, at the bottom down there, and there's some toilets at the back on the foyer on the left-hand side. So I'm going to start this talk. I don't want to waste too much time. I really want to get the conversation started. So I'm going to invite Heather Mason up. Heather's got an interesting background. She loves the theory of yoga, the practice of yoga, the science behind the yoga, and how the fusion of the two can really change someone's life. She's taught medical students at Harvard University about the fusion between the two and how they work. But all this will come out in the conversation, I'm sure. So Heather, do you want to come up and start the program off?
Hi, everybody. Good evening. How are you? You're good? Okay. So just a little bit briefly about me, above and beyond that lovely introduction from Pavan. And thank you so much for inviting me and for being here this evening as well, all of you. So this topic for me is not just an academic or an intellectual one. Standing here before you as somebody who has suffered from very high levels of different kinds of anxiety. And probably the reason I have spent so much time trying to understand it is I was trying to figure myself out. So I spent 3 years living in Buddhist monasteries. I practiced yoga, and I'm a yoga teacher and yoga therapist. Then I studied neuroscience, psychotherapy, and physiology, all really for myself and then increasingly for others, because when you suffer and you come out of suffering, you want to share that with other people as well. I think that that's a big piece of it, right? So I thought we'd start with a little fun cartoon. I don't know if you can see the writing that well. You can. Anxiety girl, able to jump to the worst conclusion in a single bound, right? Now, anxiety is not something that any of us like to experience. By its very nature, we dislike it. Like, that's part of the definition, is an uncomfortable experience. And yet, we perceive it, neuroscientists and psychologists perceive it to have some evolutionary value, right? So I just want to express what that is. So if we are actually under threat, it makes sense that our mind and body prep us to run away and to move to a point of safety. And so a lot of different physiological processes emerge in the body. Our heartbeat starts to race. Our pupils dilate. We're breathing quickly to move oxygen through the body more quickly so we have energy and so on and so forth so that we can be safe. And the other view is also that anxiety, although it captures us in modern society way too much, draws our attention to something and keeps us there to come up with a solution that will be useful for us in the future. Okay? And I think it's really important to hold that piece because certainly myself, I was so judgmental about my own experience of anxiety. And if I can see that there is a value and I was just trying to protect me, then the judgment goes away, a little bit of the shame, and in fact, the anxiety often softens. So let's just look at some statistics, which are pretty surprising, okay? So this comes from the UK Office of Statistics. In 2015 to 2016, 20% of the UK population reported having medium levels of anxiety within 1 week. And a separate 20%, so now we're talking about 40% of the UK population, reported high levels of anxiety within a given week. That's very significant. The World Health Organization reports that 10% of the entire population of the world is suffering from either depression or anxiety, them together, and that would be called comorbid, at any given time at a disorder level. So not just they feel nervous, or that's like a trait, meaning we'd say it's trait in anxiety, but actually a diagnostic level of anxiety, clinical. And then finally, there's a great review paper looking at many, many different studies of surveys that calculated that there is a 33.7% lifetime prevalence of anxiety across societies, meaning that no matter what part of the world you live in, you have a 33.7% chance at some point of your life experiencing anxiety at a level that would be clinical. That is huge. Huge, huge, huge. And I had the idea before I was doing research on all of these statistics, and actually for a chapter that I happened to be writing last week on anxiety, that there would be developing nations where the nuclear family or the extended family hadn't broken down as much, where levels of anxiety would be much smaller. But according to this amazing review paper, that's not true. Across the world, human beings are anxious. So very briefly, because we could actually spend the entire evening just on how anxiety presents in the brain. And if you guys are interested in that, you can come talk to me at the end. I can share with you some references. The most commonly referred to, I don't want to call it a pathology, but the problem that happens in the brain that manifests as anxiety is the following. So you have this frontal lobe here, right? It's like around this part of the brain. And we call that the prefrontal cortex. Okay? Have you guys heard of it? It's like a really in vogue brain structure, right? If brain structures were popular, this one would be up there. So it does a lot of different things. It helps us to take in different kinds of information and hopefully orchestrate appropriate responses. It gives us the ability to see things from new perspectives as well. So rather than habitual ways of understanding information, we have the ability to say, wait, is that different? Is that person responding to me from that perspective or that facial expression because they don't like me or they're tired? You know, it gives you some flexibility. And most importantly for anxiety, it helps to modulate that teeny little structure in red, right, which is called the amygdala. The amygdala is often termed the alarm bell of the brain. And its role is to create the entire fear response and everything that goes along with it so that if we are actually truly threatened, we can either fight or flee so that we're safe. But what happens in anxiety in a moment, right, is that amygdala will send neurotransmitters, chemicals through the brain to make sure that the prefrontal cortex is less active so that we can fight or flee. But also, if we're chronically experiencing anxiety, what happens is that frontal lobe shows up smaller and that little red space bigger, which means that we have a reduced propensity to be able to manage our sense of fear, overwhelm, nervousness, and we have a much greater reaction to any kind of perceived threat, right? So a big part of actually helping to adjust anxious experience is changing this relationship. And I think Neville and I, will speak about that this evening. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that there is this significant imbalance between two parts of the nervous system, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. So you have your brain and spinal cord, and that constitutes what we know as our central nervous system. But we also have a peripheral nervous system, meaning in the periphery of the body. And one aspect of that is known as our autonomic nervous system. You guys still with me? Yeah? Yeah? Go. Okay. And that has two parts, and you've probably heard of them. One is the sympathetic, which is fight or flight. Right? The other is the parasympathetic, which is often referred to as rest and digest. Now, what is this showing you that happens in anxiety? Which one is getting more attention? Sympathetic, significantly more attention. So we are actually in this fight and flight mode more often. We're not relaxed. And not only does it take a toll on our minds, but unfortunately, high levels of sympathetic arousal have negative impact on our body as well, right? And our relationships. Now, what do we usually do what does the health industry usually do if we show up with a high level of anxiety or something that they would even diagnose as an anxiety disorder? Well, there are generally two types of approaches, right? This is a nice little diagram here. Top down and bottom up, okay? So top down as an approach means you use the cognitive aspect in order to adjust what happens. What I mean by that is you come to me and I say to you, okay, so you're nervous every single time your boss walks towards your desk and you think you're going to get fired. And I say to you, can you notice that thought? And can you notice that thought as a belief? And can you try to let go of that and substitute it with, my boss walks past my desk because the water cooler is on the right and his office is over there and he's thirsty. Can you try to adjust that thought? So you're basically using the mind in order to alter the way that the mind is working. The most common form of top-down approach that is used in the NHS and actually in most of the developed world is called cognitive behavioral therapy. And because it's so common, many of you probably have heard of it. If not, you just heard of it right now. Okay. Unfortunately, cognitive behavioral therapy works really good in clinical trials, doesn't work as good for individuals, especially not with social anxiety, but it can be effective. Now, why would this approach not work? What is the issue here? Well, neuroscientists believe it's because that prefrontal cortex, just to come back over here, it's just not robust enough. It's not big enough and it's not active enough. So try as you might to use your mind, to alter your mind, the actual structure itself, just like a muscle, isn't strong enough to change what is happening within the brain. Okay. The other thing is that top-down approaches do not directly address the autonomic nervous system. So you can say to yourself 1,000 times, well, yeah, my boss is just walking across the room to go to the water cooler and back to his office, and yet you still feel super nervous. That's not actually helping you relax. You have that thought, but your nervous system is going, ah! Okay. Bottom-up approach. So that is when we use the body to alter the mind. And the most common form of bottom-up approach that we use is medication. Okay? So people will go on antidepressants. They know it's for anxiety, but antidepressants are often prescribed. Benzodiazepines, and you guys probably have heard of Valium, which is in that drug class. And sometimes beta blockers. Now, these tend to be relatively effective. Unfortunately, though, they all have side effects. Right? When I studied pharmacology as part of physiology, my professor of pharmacology, the first day, he said, every medicine is dangerous. Right? And he's a pharmacology professor. The other thing is that, especially with anxiety, if you remove that medication, the problem will continue to exist. So you have offered relief, which is nice, but you have not cured the problem, okay? So this is just going over what I just said. And I have one more slide before Neville and I begin our discussion. The ability of yoga to alter anxious experience in the moment, to modulate the nervous system. The ability of yoga to change the way that the brain is functioning in a moment. The ability of yoga over the long term to actually change the structures of the brain is highly significant. I believe that more and more we will appreciate, as a country and as a world, how yoga, through its multidimensional approach to health and well-being, can help curb pre-existing anxiety and prevent people from reaching diagnostic levels. Why? It increases certain neurochemicals correlated with common ease, and we will talk more about them as we dialogue. It balances the autonomic nervous system. This is a consistent finding in yoga research. I'm often surprised when I speak to the medical community that they're not actually aware that there's been a lot of yoga research. There's been a lot. As much as pharma? No, not probably even 1%. But a lot. Hundreds, even moving towards thousands of trials. It leads to changes in the brain necessary for common ease, as I mentioned, and also it's associated with a greater sense of connectedness. And often we feel anxious because we're afraid we're going to be abandoned and alone, that we're not good enough. And when we feel safe in an environment, suddenly that just shifts. There's like a paradigm shift in terms of how we relate to society and the world. So thank you. That's just my introduction. And now I think we'll both take it from here. Yeah.
Thank you. I was going to set the stage up, and we'll go on stage and we'll ask Neville to join us on stage in a moment. So Heather spoke about the framework of tonight's topic. It would be good to discuss the science behind it just to get an understanding of it. Neville, some of you may know, some of you may not, is a journalist, a writer, has been a medical and science correspondent for many national newspapers, and really has been focusing on a lot of research about the brain and how it can affect a paradigm shift in consciousness, and really follows the research in quite detail. So, you know, and also Neville's been meditating for over 30 years, and has really seen a shift of how, you know, how the mind can be changed, and also how it can then open doors, what Heather was talking about, how it can overcome anxiety. So I'm going to ask Heather to go on stage, and then Neville as well, and then I'll ask Neville just to respond to some of the things that Heather shared in a little short presentation. I'll be just sitting in the side and just listening, but ideally it's going to be a conversation between Neville and Heather, and I'll be interjecting every now and again. Towards the end, there'll be some time for some questions, because I'm sure this topic will enlighten your minds and open some avenues that you may want to explore with some questions. So I'm going to ask Neville, in a moment or two, just to share a few words. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. And thanks very much indeed, Heather, for that great authoritative and understandable introduction to the evening. Sometimes, you know, these topics can get very refined in the detail of the science, and you can lose the wider picture. But Heather's just meeting Heather properly. I had a brief meeting some months ago, but just chatting before the program began tonight, I realized that she has a wealth of experience, both from the personal perspective of her own dealing with her own anxiety and the huge amount of study that she's done to try to understand the mechanisms whereby anxiety can be relieved at a deeper level than the more simple approaches that have bring limited benefits. And then the compassion that has led her to try to share these things. And she's working at all sorts of levels in our society to try to bring these benefits of yoga and contemplative traditions to the attention of the wider public, and especially of healthcare professionals. So it's a really great privilege to have her with us. Her presentation reminded me of a number of key things from my own learning. One thing she was reminding me of when she was talking about the autonomic nervous system was many years back, I spent quite a lot of time with a cardiologist at a London hospital, a teaching hospital, who reckoned that he could help the great majority of his heart patients by explaining to them how mishandling their own nervous system had led on to the heart attack. And this education that he gave them, rather than, you know, telling them that it was eating too much butter or that their blood pressure figures were wrong or anything like that, he actually would give them an education about how that you have the parasympathetic, which is like the rest and repair system. You have the sympathetic, which releases energy for action. And almost invariably in these heart attack patients, they had driven themselves so that the sympathetic system became exhausted and they weren't giving the parasympathetic a chance to muscle in and restore balance within the system. There is our bodies contain a great deal of variable capacities, but they have to work within certain limits determined by what they call the homeostasis of the body, so that you can push yourself so far, but after a certain point, as Heather was indicating, if you go beyond a certain point, you get less for that increased effort, and you get, you're actually getting less and less for more and more effort. And I think probably there are quite a lot of people in today's world who are in this sort of plight, where they're pushing themselves harder and harder to keep up with such a fast-paced world, but they're at risk of, especially because of all the stimuli that are available to us through social media and our connectedness through technology, more at risk than ever of pushing ourselves beyond the point where we're really functioning in ways where our brain is cool and able to make right decisions, and we can move more and more away from a deeper sort of understanding of the self, which is the other side that I'd like to say a few words of introduction about, because it's been so important to me in my own journey. That is that I feel now as if a huge shift has happened in me, a huge cognitive shift, I would say. I think that the limits of something like cognitive behavioral therapy that were being explained by Heather, that comes about because, yes, to reframe your understanding will be helpful, but some of the things that are really deeply troubling us may not be amenable to a simple reframing. It requires a more of a kind of shift in your whole outlook, your whole understanding of who you are. And one of the core pathological ideas that we suffer from in our very materialistic society, where science has given us so much but has really neglected the inner being and consciousness and the mind, actually, one of the great pathologies is to define ourselves in terms of our brains and our bodies. There are a number of very good scientists who are saying we are not our brains. There's more and more work pointing in this direction, that there is an aspect to us which is like the agency that runs the brain, the agency that runs this body. One of the things that I'm really interested in exploring is the idea that when the brain it has become dysfunctional in the ways that Heather was describing, it's particularly hard to know yourself in this deeper sense. But if you can access this transcendent aspect of who we are, which is non-material, then that actually, in my experience, puts you in the driving seat, or it's capable of putting you in the driving seat, so that you become much better able to make choices about your thoughts and your feelings, so that you can actually send thanks to this phenomenon of neuroplasticity that Heather touched on, that the brain changes according to how we use it. It is really plastic. It's like our muscles, you know, you use it or you lose it. And we really can change the brain structure quite substantially when there has been a traumatic loss, like through a stroke or something else. Often the scientists have been able to show that The brain will reorganize itself if the will is there, so that lost functions will be replaced by other parts of the brain. So the plasticity is there. The capacity, this doesn't only apply to skills, it also applies to states of mind. There was a very interesting study of some biotechnology company workers in California some years back, where they were known to be low morale was a problem in the company, and it's known that there's a part of the frontal cortex, I think it's the left side, where there are neurons associated with feelings of depression, and there's an equivalent, and then there's an equivalent on the left side known to be associated with feelings of positivity. And they, sure enough, when they studied these workers, they found that the neurons associated with these low feelings were more active in brain scanning tests than the positive neurons. And a 10-week course of mindfulness meditation, where they were taught to be more self-aware, to be coming into the moment, to learn some techniques of beginning to access the self that is a kind of still small voice within, rather than the self that is always trying to express itself out here. Just that 10 weeks shifted that from predominant activity of the miserable neurons to the cheerful neurons. So it can really, this was a very, very good demonstration that you can really change your mind through your brain quite quickly. But I'd like to ask Heather more about her particular focus and her journey, because I'm also aware that sometimes, because of certain blocks that may have been left by certain traumas, it's just not possible to step back from this kind of anxious state. So how does, in your experience, how did you manage it? Because you spoke of having been on a long journey, including 3 years in a monastery, to try to overcome those tendencies toward anxiety in yourself. How did you do it, and how does the science support what you did?
I think it's a... How did I do it? You know, how I did it, very interestingly, is probably not what, as the leader of the Minded Institute, this organization that I own, that I am expressing and touting as the way forward. Because I really did use the mind to work with the mind in very much the way that you are describing. And that plasticity that is available to us eventually arose for me. But because I was so anxious, depressed, and suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, to be really honest, it took 2 years of sitting with constant rumination before I was actually able to have a certain level of clarity. And it was almost like my brain was changing and my mind was being infused with information from the outside from my teacher. And then I guess that was heightening certain responses in my brain and giving rise to this capacity. When I came back from that 3-year stint, I thought to myself, how am I going to tell other people how to overcome their depression and anxiety? Because my response is, go live in silence in a monastery in Southeast Asia for 3 years. And every time I tell somebody that, they walk away or they change the subject. So obviously there's something wrong. I was already a yoga teacher. I was also an ex-gymnast. So I didn't really understand yoga very much in the beginning of my meditation. I thought it was a competitive sport. I was all about asana. Later on, though, as I was trying to help people and felt a little bit helpless in trying to help others, and I studied yoga therapy, it became clear to me that there were certain things that yoga offered which could help support that ability of mine to give rise to neurological change. And those are now borne out in scientific research studies that are really interesting. And I'd like to describe just a few of the things to you that can happen, and maybe towards the end, some of the ways that you can engender that response, you can actually provoke it. So one of the most interesting things to come out of the yoga literature came out in 2007, 2010, 2012, and was published again this year by the same researcher, Dr. Chris Streeter, at the Boston University School of Medicine. And she was very interested, as a psychiatrist and neurologist, as to why certain things were happening after yoga practice that were common for people where they would normally use specific drug classes, like they were having less seizures, less anxiety, less post-traumatic stress, and less chronic pain. And she thought, what's the overlapping medication we use? Well, we use things like Valium. Yoga helps all these conditions. What does Valium work on? Well, it works on helping to increase the availability of a certain neurotransmitter called GABA. GABA is the inhibitory neurotransmitter of the brain, and for our intents and purposes, what it inhibits is the fear network. And for some reason, when you practice yoga, you actually increase the amount of GABA available in the brain. And she studied this. She studied that initially in 2007. And her detractors said, well, maybe any movement can do that. In fact, maybe any intervention could do that. Who are you to say it was yoga? And she said, you're right. She's a very serious scientist. I'm going to compare it to a form of exercise that reaches the same metabolic rate, that's also indoors, and is also done in a group. Guess who had the higher levels of GABA? The yoga group. So then she came up with a very interesting hypothesis with another psychiatrist named Dr. Gebhard, because the two of them were having very weird experiences in clinical practice. They had been working analytically with people for years. And then they were starting to teach them slow breathing and yoga, and people who were not shifting out of their anxiety were doing yoga for like a few months and having the biggest shift in their way that they saw the world and in their anxiety as well. And they thought, what's going on here? So they put forth a very elaborate hypothesis, which they published in 2012, and since then a lot of other research is supporting. And what they said is, when you practice yoga, especially with controlled breathing, you send messages up a certain nerve that connects to your lungs and the rest of your viscera. And this nerve, when you are breathing at a slow rate, and when you are moving in kind of a slow, controlled form, the messages it sends to the brain cause GABA to be released at a much higher level than you would during other activity. So that was that piece. That's how it's happening, they thought. And they already knew GABA was increasing, but this was the bigger piece of the puzzle that they started to put together. They said, well, yes, GABA is inhibitory towards the fear network, but it also helps in inhibiting the fear network to enhance the activity of the prefrontal cortex. And another structure called the insular cortex, responsible for our sense of self. And so they said, this increase in GABA is decreasing amygdala activity, increasing prefrontal cortical activity, and increasing our sense of who we are in a clear way. And research is now supporting that. So that's really cool. And here, just one more piece about this. It takes about an hour for Valium to increase levels of GABA in your brain. Guess how long it takes with yoga? About an hour. Really interesting. The one other piece, if I can just add to it, that I think is important, once again, it's very difficult if that muscle, we can think of the prefrontal cortex as almost as a muscle, is not strong enough, we can't use the mind to change the mind. So what else can we do, right? So just to backtrack for a second, but with that context, I have a colleague named Tim Gard, and he wanted to look at the brains of yogis versus the brain of non-yogis. And he wanted to see what's the most significant difference between these two brains. Now, everybody thought he was going to find enlarged prefrontal cortices. It wasn't what he found. I'm not saying he didn't find they were bigger, but that wasn't the most important or most salient element. Instead, what he found was a special part of the brain that's kind of in the center called the caudate, was more connected to the motor network, how we move, and the cognitive network, how we think. And that was the biggest difference between these brains. Now that was a curious finding. What did it mean? And this is what he and other people have started to hypothesize. So that's a two-year-old finding. Yoga, not only yoga, but things like yoga, tai chi, qigong, operate by excitation and inhibition. You initiate a movement, and then you stop. And then you initiate another movement, and then you stop. And you do this in a very controlled way, over and over and over again. Right? And the caudate is involved in that with the motor network. It helps you to do this, to take a fork, to put your fingers around it and stop, to lift up that fork to your mouth and not jam it into your lip, but to stop, to open your mouth, and you get the point, right? I don't need to keep going. But somehow, in a way that he can't quite explain, that process of starting and stopping in the asanas gave rise to that same connectivity with the cognitive circuits, meaning that by starting and stopping asana, you could also initiate a thought on purpose and then inhibit it. Get anxious and say, actually, I'm not going to think this way. I'm going to alter what's happening. This is so important because trying when you are anxious to come out of that anxiety can be hellish and you feel like you're failing. But if through the process of starting and stopping action you build that faculty, then the work has been so much easier. So that's a big piece of what I'm teaching, Neville.
That's yeah. Beautiful. Double benefit. Reducing the blocks on cognitive function.
Yes.
Also actually improving the cognitive function in the sense of creating that ability to look at something coming up and then move back from it. Very, very interesting indeed. I'd like to ask you something in this connection. When many years back, over the decades, doctors have had a variety of anti-anxiety medicines. For a long time, it was the barbiturates, and then the benzodiazepines came in, of which Valium is one. And it was thought for many years, it was maintained that they weren't addictive, and so people were taking the benzodiazepines over very long periods, years, mm-hmm. decades in some instances. Mm-hmm. Then it's actually when a new set of drugs was coming along, it was acknowledged that the benzodiazepines, which by now were out of patent protection, mm-hmm. so not earning so much money, it was acknowledged that they weren't so good because of this addictive element. And the wave spread through the medical profession for people who've been on them long term, always the acknowledgement that, you know, as a short-term help, they're very valuable. Yeah. Like someone's in acute distress, they can be a wonderful aid to help you through a crisis. But people taking them for years, when this fashion came for people to come off them, amazingly, it was found that the worries that they'd been to the doctor with all those years before came rushing back. They'd just been put on hold. You know, there was a sort of deeper thing than the pill had been able to deal with. Yeah. It had given them some function in the meantime, but it hadn't actually dealt with that source of the anxiety. I'm wondering whether mechanisms. I'm wondering. I can see that sometimes when a person is in a distressed state, there's no way that they can hear about, you know, profound cognitive shifts, perhaps of the kind that you were working with over that period in the monastery. And for me, it's taken me a long time to make a very deep shift in my sense of who I am.
Yeah.
From being very identified with my roles in the world, of dad and family man and husband and journalist and all of those things, And I was defining myself through those, which actually I can see now as a source of a lot of anxiety, because when you're defined with externals to yourself, they are always in a state of change. And if your definition of who you are is linked too closely to those things, you're going to suffer, as sure as eggs are eggs. So the shift to a more inner identification, the language we use is the traditional language of the soul, you know, the inner being. That shift took me years to really make it, you know. It took a lot of exposure to this understanding, because I was very deeply programmed, I think, with the idea that I am my brain and my body. That's how I worked as a science writer, and that's the predominant thinking in mainstream science. Yeah. But this shift, I feel, is there's a jackpot that can come with this shift. And I feel that the techniques that you're describing, they could, if you didn't accompany them with a deeper shift like this, you know, some means of connecting to the inner being and the beautiful qualities that you learn about in yourself when you self-define in that way, rather than through the anxious self that is trying to prove itself out there. I've got a feeling that this is like a jackpot that could be, you could move towards it through the methods that you're describing, but if you remained only in those physical mechanisms of breathing and posture or whatever, or these other techniques, that you might not be able, you might actually not deal with the underlying angst that had been the problem in the first place. What do you think?
God, it's such an interesting question. And there are various layers to that answer. So I think it's important, firstly, to understand that the release of GABA internally, endogenously, as opposed to using Valium, which we call exogenous, right, coming from an outside source, is very different. I don't disagree with you that you need to have a significant cognitive shift that is almost like a moment of illumination or epiphany, where we see the world differently and we experience ourselves differently. But I don't think that it is actually divergent from the neurological perspective to get just into a little greater depth around what the psychiatrist that I was talking about actually had experienced in their clinical practice. And there's this great story. So one of these two psychiatrists actually has been my mentor for years. She's this amazing woman. She is in her 60s, and she was like one of the first women at Harvard Medical School to become a psychiatrist, just like really sharp. And she tells this story, I don't mean to shock anybody, but of this individual who was sexually abused. And as a result of that, she had a perception of her buttocks as being really oddly and irregularly shaped. And so she was very, very embarrassed of her buttocks. And she would do everything in her power to hide it through clothes and to not even go out where it could be seen. And for years, they tried to work on a perception and reappraisal of her relationship to herself, and also finding greater congruency, because objectively there was nothing oddly shaped about it. But she started doing these breathing techniques, and somehow she showed up one day and she said, I don't know what happened, but doing the breathing technique I came to this place of deep calm and relaxation, and somehow I realized that my body was healthy and well, and that it was not ill-formed, and I felt my body, and I realized the shape of it was normal, or whatever that means, you know, but whatever normal means. And so this led the psychiatrist to go on, as well as Dr. Streeter, and now also somebody named Dr. Bud Craig, to hypothesize that what happens is when you release this GABA, it actually changes the circuitry. And when the circuitry changes within the brain, especially in this insular cortex, what actually happens in relationship to that, or is correlated with that, is this complete shift of self-perception. And I think it can happen for us without the physical practice. I think some of us can start to sit still, close our eyes, sense into our breath, connect to this godlike energy or universal energy, and we have that shift, which would be correlated with a change in the insula. And others of us know we need to move and breathe in particular ways. But whatever way you write it, I think that it is associated with a shift in the brain. And once that occurs, there isn't an underlying problem, that actually that breathing and moving readjusts our reality through the brain.
Mm.
And so that you wouldn't find it continuing to rise. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yes, it's very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, it's lovely, actually. And also, I especially like this equivalence that you're describing. You know, that we can't really separate matter from mind. Ultimately, they have a very close connection, a much closer connection than has been acknowledged in materialistic science.
Mm-hmm.
They really do work together. But for me, there's been a great deal of benefit in realizing which comes first, because I do think that there's a distinction. They're closely developed, but the way I understand it is that that according to the thoughts and feelings that are going on in my mind, that will be my experience in life. There was a beautiful book by Marianne Williamson called A Return to Love. You might
mm-hmm.
remember that. She had this wonderful saying, thought is cause, she meant thought stroke feeling, is cause, experience is effect. If you're not happy with the effects in your life, you have to change the nature of your thinking. And she said, with love in your life, with love in your mind, there'll be love in your life. With fear in your mind, there'll be fear in your life. So this is absolutely really a confirmation of what you're saying, that the manifestation and the origin are absolutely interlinked. And I definitely agree that you can work on the manifest side, which is the material side, like the brain and the amygdala and those other mechanisms. You can work on them, and you will. There is a feedback to the mind also, which could put the mind in a better state, whereby it could then be changing the brain,
exactly.
The manifest side. But I'd like to ask you a little bit about this aspect of love, because it strikes me as being an element that I'd like to see more studies on. I know there's a lot of work on compassion, especially in the States, not so much here in the UK, but a lot of studies of this now, helped by the Dalai Lama and his interest in science, and of
mm-hmm.
course compassion at the root of the Buddhist tradition. But it does seem to me to be extraordinarily important. It was one of the things that allowed me to start on my Raja Yoga journey. I met these yogis who were practicing through their own connection with the divine, were able to vibrate a positive energy that was greater than anything I'd ever met in the newsroom or anywhere else, you know, in my work. And it felt like that was a huge help to me in starting off. It's not enough, because it's almost, you could say it's from outside in. It's somebody else's energy that I was taking the benefit from. But it did make a difference in, a bit like you're saying that, you know, you can work on your breathing, you can work on these other techniques, and that they will then feed into the mind, that strengthens the mind. In the same way, the vibrations from these yogis fed into my being and started to put me on my feet. But then subsequently, I had to sort of make the inner shift of the study and all the rest of it that I think would give me an outlook that was more in line with this basically loving nature that we are. And just one more comment in that area. I was mentioning to you earlier, and I think you're familiar with his work, there's this New York psychiatrist, Norman Doidge, who wrote a book, very good book, came out a few years back, called The Brain That Changes Itself. And I think it's a misnomer, personally, because I don't think the brain does change itself. The brain is more, in my understanding now, the brain is like a computer or a tool, and it's you that change your brain if you choose to. You need to have that understanding. It empowers you very deeply if you make that shift. But it's full of wisdom and full of solid evidence about this phenomenon of neuroplasticity, that the brain changes according to how you use it. And one of the things that they came up with was that there are two circumstances when the brain is ultra neuroplastic. One is when you're in love, and the other one is when you become a parent. Mm-hmm. Because it's as if, you know, your brain equips you with a certain set of conditionings, responses to life that enable you to fulfill certain roles. Then, for example, growing up with your parents. Then you fall in love, and it's as if the mechanism is given to us by nature, whereby all those different feelings trigger changes in the brain at a very deep level, in the DNA of the neurons themselves, and you get this ultra-plastic condition where a new set of conditions can be established inside you. It's a very fascinating element of all this.
So... So I think I would
pick on something that you said. You know, when you talk about this combination of the brain and the mind, there's other therapies like tapping, EFT, EMDR, where they're physical therapies that alter your state of mind and make you feel happy or less anxious. And that may be a temporary mode, but is it similar to that, where it's a way in to connect into yourself and the mind to then take that next step up? Is it like the backdoor entrance into that journey to a less anxious state? Or, yeah.
Okay, so I'll respond to that first and then to the love question. So the tapping and the EMDR, the eye movement reprocessing and desensitization, which is used commonly with people who have post-traumatic stress, where they tell the story and then a therapist will move their hand back and forth and one is meant to fall with their eyes. Those actually have very specific identified theoretical neural correlates, like specific things that happen in the brain. So I think it's more than just we're connecting internally. Like what happens here, when you're traumatized, there is damage in a part of the brain called your hippocampus. And your hippocampus, when you sleep at night, would send certain wavelengths back and forth between the two different sides of the brain to take information from the short-term repository to the long-term repository, where you would be able to make sense of it and integrate it into your experience. If you can't do that, what happens is this glitch in the brain. And we see that in like a Hollywood sense as flashbacks, where pieces of information are presenting. So I think specifically EMDR, it's not that it's connecting us to a deeper essence of ourselves. It's helping to complete something that the brain was unable to do and using really intelligent neuroscientific techniques. The tapping is a little bit more in depth to explain neuroscientifically, so I might just leave that for a moment. That may, though, actually bring us back to connection, but there's also some neuroscience. But the love piece, in addition, I think it's really interesting. I don't disagree with it. And I want you guys to know I'm not a materialist. Like, I think that the mind has incredible power. I believe in the power of thought, the power of love. I believe that when you think about somebody and you close your mind and you really imagine them, if your mind is clear, that they can feel it. And yet, I'm going to take it back to the materialistic perspective nonetheless. So, there is definitely psychological research and neurological research supporting the understanding that when we feel loved, that we are able to give rise to more neuroplastic change. That is true. And there's an amazing scientist in the United States. If you guys are interested in this, I really suggest you look up his work. His name is Stephen Porges, and that is spelled P-O-R-G-E-S for any of you who are interested. And he is really the father of this particular nerve called the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is the biggest cranial nerve in the body. It comes out of the brainstem, and it moves all over the viscera. And it gets its name from the Latin to wander. It's a wandering nerve. And what he says, and what research has been showing for probably the last 15 years, is that when this nerve is very well toned, because it connects up to the throat, because it connects up to the muscles of the face, because it connects up to even our breathing apparatus, that when it's well-toned, we have better interpersonal relationships and we will naturally feel safer, right? And we will engage in pro-social behaviors when it's more toned. But here's the other piece, and this relates to exactly what you're saying. When this nerve is more toned, and when we are specifically in a situation where we're increasing the activity of that branch of the nerve, our entire nervous system is naturally more flexible. That's why if you want to tell your partner or your child or your mother something, father, really difficult, it's probably not a good time when they're in a state of high level of sympathetic arousal, but rather when they're engaged, when their voice is changing, when they feel empathetic, because at that moment, they literally have a more flexible brain. So love, for sure, not lust, because lust is something very different. It acts like cocaine does, and you become addicted and actually less flexible. But I'm talking about like love with children, love of a long-term partner, love of God, all of those things are associated with a greater amount of tone in this nerve, which leads to a greater amount of safety, which then, and on and on and on, leads to this actual flexibility within the nervous system. And what's also really interesting, there's actually a very well-known researcher in this country called Paul Gilbert, who looks at compassion and love. And what he says is if you try to take somebody who's had a difficult early life experience and teach them to just think loving thoughts, you know what happens? They have the reverse experience because all they think of is, I don't love me. I can't say I want to feel loving. I can't love somebody else, or I don't feel worthy of loving myself enough to be loved back. But if, once again, you tone the vagus through doing some kinds of breathing and moving techniques, that changes, and then that person can experience love for themselves and others and become more flexible.
Fabulous. Yeah, that's a really wonderful explanation of this beautiful crossover between what's happening in us in terms of our thoughts and feelings and how that translates and is constantly accompanied by physical expression.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think so that beyond all of that, I really also honor that you're speaking about this level of transcendence beyond the physical, and that there is that place where you're just sitting with somebody, even if you don't feel safe, and that other person is so grounded that there's just this field, and they kind of bring you into that field, and in that moment, safety emerges, and you change in a way that we can't quantify.
No, but it's real, yeah. And I'm sure that if you were wired up in a fMRI machine or magnetoencephalography or something like that, you'd see all the accompaniments going on as you experience those very powerful vibrations of love and peace and joy.
Yeah.
It is a gift, but it's a gift that you then have to work with. You know, that's the thing. And I think it's probably the same. That's what I was getting at in a way with what you were telling me about earlier with the GABA-inducing techniques, that they would be a gift, but you then must, in that more peaceful state, you've got a better chance of understanding the possibly the wrong thinking or the wrong conditioning that caused your anxiety in the first place. So you have to do that work too, I feel.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're going to be running out of time soon. We'll have some questions and answers in a few minutes. But before we do, I just want to ask both of you just to share for a couple of minutes briefly about what we could do on a daily basis. You know, we're going to walk out of here, go home tonight. We're going to worry about the traffic. We're going to worry about getting home. We're going to worry about getting ready for work tomorrow. We're going to worry about this. So rewiring our anxious minds and brains, it's like Neville was saying, it's a commitment, it's a journey, it's a process. But, you know, simple steps lead to a longer journey. So in a couple of minutes, what's your kind of takeaway tips or advice? Yeah, one by one. So Heather, you go first, ladies first.
So I'm just going to give you two really simple things, and they work. I mean, I've been running the Minded Institute for 10 years, seeing many, many people, and my students see many, many people. I think the easier they are, the more likely you are to do them on a daily basis. So you want to tone this vagus nerve, right? Because the vagus is the part that helps with that social engagement network and the release of GABA. So if you exhale for double the length of your inhalation, that actually helps to tone that nerve. Every single time you exhale, messages are sent from the brain back down that vagus, helping it over time, just like a muscle, to become stronger. So let's just do three breaths together, where we're going to inhale for a count of three and exhale for a count of six. We do that? Right? So you can have your eyes open or closed, whatever you'd like. And just gently inhale. Two, three, four. Exhale. Two, three, four, five, six. Inhale. Two, three, four. Exhale, two, three, four, five, six. Inhale, two, three. Exhale, two, three, four, five, six. And if you did that every day for 15 minutes, for 3 months, you would feel significant changes and your heart would be much healthier. Really. The other thing, super simple. This comes from the Kundalini yoga tradition. It's called Kirtan Kriya. And what you do is to bring your thumb and your little finger together, right? And they use Satanama, which just means in the name of truth. So you do Satanama, 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 Satanama. Close your eyes, we'll do it a few more. Satanama, Satanama, Satanama. Great. Okay. You can do more. And this, there's a big part of your motor network devoted to your hands, so you use quite a lot of your brain just by using your fingers. And you're using that inhibition plus initiation that I talked about by doing this, plus focusing the mind at the same time. And you can do that. It's recommended by the Kundalini tradition for 11 minutes, but I usually say about 5. So 15 minutes of the other breathing, 5 minutes of this, your life will change. And I'm not one of those like infomercials say, do this and there'll be magic. I'm telling you, your life will change. Okay? Neville, please.
There's, I think I'd like to connect my own practice, which is really because of the Raja Yoga and having done it for a long time. it's very elevating. So I'll just wait till that passes. Some years back, there was a study done by Professor Hans Eysenck, who was a very leading psychologist in London, came from Germany originally, and he was an expert on personalities, he was an expert on IQ tests, all of these things. He was famous for pioneering a lot of these things, neuroticism scales. I remember him describing neurosis as an inability to follow the carrot or the stick. You know, life gives you certain signals, don't do that, but do this, and you'll feel good, or don't do that, or you'll get the stick. And a neurotic behavior is where you keep doing things that hurt you, and you can't move towards the things that you love. And he did a big trial of people who were high on neuroticism score, where half were assigned to regular visits to their GP, and half were given a kind of therapy that involved them being invited to, the beginning of it was like the group, and they were invited to consider a time when they had felt most at peace with themselves and the world, to take their minds back to a time where they had that. And it might be a father would say, well, I used to go fishing at this pond with my son. You know, we never caught anything, but it was so beautiful in the early morning. A whole range of different things. And he would, in this half who had this therapy, they were connected to that feeling. And then monthly they met and reignited that sense of the higher self, as I would put it, those positive feelings. And they found, after the study ran for a few years, the group that didn't have this treatment had the usual high levels of heart disease and other illnesses, including cancer. Neurosis makes you very vulnerable to premature ill health. They were unchanged, but the group that had this, their illness rates were returned to average. It was a dramatic difference between the two groups. So I would say that however you do it, find something that allows you to connect to that love and peace that is inside you. For me now, from having been a complete atheist, actually, because of materialistic view, I now sense that there is actually an entity that is like unlimited love and peace, and I can connect to that with my mind, and I love doing that. And so that's my practice, that's my tip. But I know that as a tip, you know, that requires a certain amount of acceptance to do that. But this it's in the same category as what Isaac was doing with those patients, that you're taking yourself into a place of positive, peaceful, loving energy, and that then translates into better health record, no doubt mediated by the kind of mechanisms we've been hearing about in such beautiful detail, but it also translates into a better life. Your experience of life improves.
Perfect, thank you. So we've got 10 minutes for some questions. There'll be a microphone, so if you've got any questions, you put your hand up and the microphone will come to you, and we'll take some questions. There's one lady over there, and there's one lady over there as well.
You said that you can't use the mind to heal the mind. Do you believe in affirmations?
Me? Yeah. I think affirmations can work, but once again, I think that affirmations are most powerful when the mind is relaxed. I think my affirmations are less powerful when there is a high level of anxiety present in the mind. So, do I believe in them? Yes. Do I think that they're the easiest inroads into healing as an initial state? No. But that doesn't mean I'm right.
Heather, I wanted to ask, when you were talking about love, you mentioned lust really quickly and said that it was something different, and I just wanted to hear a little bit more about that, if I can.
Say your question again, I'm so sorry.
When you were talking about love, you mentioned lust really quickly and said it's like cocaine and it's...
Okay.
And I just wanted to know a bit more about that.
Sure. So when you experience lustful love, it gives rise to specifically an increased level of dopamine in the brain. Very high levels of dopamine. And it's not actually cocaine that we crave. It's the cocaine causes a high release of dopamine, which is incredibly pleasurable. And so when we come into contact with another person, for whatever reason, causes us to feel that very heightened experience, we release a very high level of dopamine. And as a result, we literally become addicted to that person. And also, and many of you will know, falling in love can be incredibly nerve-wracking. You're like, am I going to say the wrong thing? You feel nauseous, you can't sleep. And that is very different from the very pleasant kind of love where you've rested in a relationship or with a family member or friend you trust. Yeah.
So question here, next to Miriam.
Thank you for the talk, and I just want to ask Heather a question about yoga classes that you run, whether they are personalized yoga classes, one-to-one basis, or is it general yoga classes, and because I think that would really help.
So the Institute, I generally run classes more for people that I'm training to work with other people. Although I do see some private clients. But the Institute runs 8-week courses, all of my graduates, because I have a 2-year training program in my methodology. So all my graduates teach the 8-week course for depression and anxiety that we've built, and which is actually shown through research to reduce depression and anxiety as well. They all see people individually, and they have lots of their own programs. You can look on our website, The Minded Institute, and you'll find our amazing therapists that work with people individually and in groups. Yeah.
Thank you. Heather, this question is for Heather. I just wanted to, you mentioned about the breathing techniques, whereas breathing counting 3 and then breathe out counting 6. I was just wondering whether if you pause after counting 3, after counting 3 and then pause the breath and then count 6, is that a really good technique to...
You mean if you inhale for 3, exhale for 6, hold out for 6 or 3 and then inhale again for 3?
Yeah, hold on.
Yeah, actually, that's really, really good for anxiety. But I didn't teach it here because if you're incredibly and acutely anxious, holding a breath can cause you fear. Just very quickly, because this is a really important and interesting neurological and physiological point. So what happens is we're constantly creating carbon dioxide in our body, right? We do that because in order to have energy, we burn off glucose within our bodies, and when we burn off glucose, an end result of that glucose is carbon dioxide, yeah? Now, our ability to tolerate carbon dioxide levels in our body is directly related to our ability to manage stress. Now, if carbon dioxide levels are too high, like really too high, then our blood becomes acidic, and that's dangerous. We have very special mechanisms that when they increase, we expel that carbon dioxide quickly, like when you're exercising, to make sure your blood doesn't become acidic. However, if actually the mechanism that's involved is called your chemoreflex, your respiratory chemoreflex, and it works and interacts with your sympathetic nervous system. If you can teach yourself through breath holding to be able to manage a slightly greater level of healthy carbon dioxide levels, what happens is you don't orchestrate that sympathetic response, and as a result, you're actually more resilient. So there is a direct relationship between being able to hold your breath, either in or out, for a certain period of time, and your psychological resiliency, which can be built through breath holding. You're welcome.
Hi. Is there any kind of technique for sort of those underlying emotions that can cause anxiety, like guilt or anything like that?
In the teachings, as I've experienced them through the Brahma Kumaris, that issue is addressed, but it's not so much to do with the technique, although, as I said, this coming into an atmosphere of this feelings of acceptance and compassion is a help. You know, when you are with people who are feeling like that, it diminishes feelings of guilt. But the teachings as well, the sort of st- story that is told within the spiritual university about humanity, its original nature, how that has become overlaid with other things which causes distress, and consequently sometimes we're behaving in ways that we then try to control through guilt. Those mechanisms are understood, but then with that understanding and acceptance that's part of nature, in a sense, that we're at a time in history where that kind of problem is widely prevalent, with that kind of reframing of your own circumstances so that you can look at yourself with a degree of detachment instead of, oh, I'm so bad, you know. That in itself, no doubt helped by the kind of mechanisms that Heather's been talking about, aids you in being able to move forward in a better way rather than continuing with the guilt. That is a question of practicing hearing the ideas over quite a long period of time so that the penny drops, that I don't, perhaps I use guilt in the past to try and control my behaviour or to beat myself up because I didn't like some aspect of my behaviour, but actually that's not really helping me get out of it. You know, this needs to be recognised. And then when that recognition is there, you've got a much better chance of moving into the states of being where those feelings just are finished. I hope that makes some sense. Oh, great, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understood myself, but I think I did.
Just got one more question at the front, I think. We've got
time. This gentleman over here, for the person bringing the mic around, with the hat.
I remember one of the senior teachers said at one point, guilt has no place on the path of transformation. Resonant statement. I like that very much.
Yeah, one of the things that's not very well known is our problem is wanting. When you want to control something, you can't control it.
Mm-hmm.
When you want approval, you don't have approval. Or when you want to be safe, you don't have it while you're wanting safe. Mm-hmm. So if you can let go of that wanting to be safe or wanting mm-hmm. control or wanting approval, mm-hmm. and do that for a while,
mm.
you'll make a lot of progress, I can guarantee that.
That's very nice.
I do that every day, and I just erase stuff, all sorts of things. And it's
very nice.
Very workable, yeah.
I'd like to add a little saying that means a lot to me. Scientists are moving into a very refined understanding of the material world now. Are they seeing everything as vibration? They describe this quantum field as being the most deep level of reality, and mind and consciousness and information work within that. And there's a saying that the quantum field, which is like a sea of energy, does not respond to what you want, but to who you are being. So if you're kind of wanting something, you're not on the same wavelength as that quality within the quantum field. If you make the conscious choice to put yourself in a state of peace, for example, or a state of love, that you have all you need, then that comes to you. It's a very interesting shift from, as you say, from that state of wanting and needing, which most of us find ourselves into different degrees, but which never works.
Okay, so this concludes our evening for today. I just want to thank Neville and thank Heather for a fantastic conversation. So what we're going to do now is just have a brief meditation. Miriam will be some thoughts, and we'll just sit back, relax, and just go with the meditation. And after that, I'm just going to make a couple of small announcements, and then that'll be the end for the evening.
And please stay for them.
So let me be with myself for this next few minutes. Breathing in and breathing out on a longer scale. A few times. as I do this breathing, let me be very aware of my heart and feel the energy that is passing through as I'm breathing in and breathing out the stress, the worries, the anxiety which I may have experienced today. I may close my eyes or keep them open. But what I'm doing now is refocusing on being present and connected. I'm grounding myself, feeling at ease and comforted by what I heard just this evening, being in this atmosphere. And I have this deep interest in shifting these disturbing thoughts and feelings which I may experience from time to time. So let me hold in my heart and mind the vision of how it can happen, how I am going to make it happen from the time I'm going to leave this place and venture outside. It's not that I'm going to work it out by magic, but it's going to be happening naturally. Me using some tips I've been given in a creative way, using them in my day-to-day life. I'm very grateful, very hopeful, and I have this sense of knowing that I can do it and that it will happen the more I practice letting things come up, observing them and letting them go. And deepening that sense of self-appreciation, self-acceptance with my all my different parts within my soul, within I, the soul.